This is Law and Disorder.
Today in Law and Disorder, we're going to discuss the victory of the lawsuit against John Ashcroft.
Amazingly, a federal appeals court held that John Ashcroft misused the material witness statute as a means of preventively detaining people after 9/11. And amazingly, the case against him has passed through the first important stage on its way to a victory.
We'll also hear about a Freedom of Information Act lawsuit to make public the FBI's investigative operational guidelines on the investigation of Muslims and mosques.
The Bush administration showed the guidelines to various civil liberties groups, but now the Obama administration is refusing to release them.
Stay with us.
In August of this year, a three-judge appellate court of the Ninth Circuit held that John Ashcroft could be sued for the illegal and unconstitutional detention of American Muslims. The lawsuit was brought by Abdullah El-Kid, an American citizen and African American. In 2003, El-Kid was arrested and detained under very abusive conditions, without any evidence that he had done any wrong or without any evidence of probable cause. The lawsuit asked damages against Ashcroft for abusing the material witness statute to preventively detain American Muslims, and in particular, Abdullah El-Kid. Joining us to talk in depth about this important case and the utter misuse of the material witness statute is ACLU attorney Lee Gallant. Lee is the deputy director of the Immigrants' Rights Project at the ACLU. He has litigated many cases, including the Detroit Free Press case against Ashcroft and the North Jersey Media Group against Ashcroft, which involved challenges to the government's post-September 11th policy of holding secret deportation hearings. Lee, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Lee, I was extraordinarily pleased recently to read about a recent victory you had in a Ninth Circuit argument, a case called El-Kid v. our former Attorney General, John Ashcroft. And it had to do with what's called a material witness detention. But let's take a step back and say, what was that? What was the case about? What is material witness detention? Was that post 9/11? What are we talking about in this case? It was, for all of us, I think, a huge boost to see this victory, an impossible victory in many ways. But give us a little explanation of the background.
Sure. The material witness statute has been around for almost our whole country's history, and not many people knew about it. And the reason not many people knew about it is because it was so rarely used. It had a very, very limited purpose before 9/11. What it could be used for is if you had someone who had genuinely material information for a criminal proceeding and there was hard evidence that they would not testify and it was critical that the information be brought out at a trial, the government had a very limited exception to the normal arrest powers to arrest a witness and to say, we need your testimony. But what the government did was get the testimony very quickly and then release the person. And it was obviously rarely used, especially with U.S. citizens, because it's such a draconian thing to arrest a witness.
Who hadn't done anything. So, for example, I witness a mafia hit, and the heck if I want to testify about a mafia hit, and the government says, well, we need your testimony, we're going to put you in custody, get your testimony right away in front of the grand jury or the court, and then either release me or put me in a secret witness program, whatever I'm going to do. But it's used in that kind of narrow circumstances.
Exactly, exactly. And it's someone who's completely innocent, who's not charged with a crime, who's simply a witness. And one of the things that Congress did was say, if it's taking too long, take the person's deposition, even if you can't have live testimony, because you simply cannot hold a witness for a long time because they're completely innocent. And even then, with all those safeguards, it was rarely used. Well, then what happens after 9/11 is someone in the Justice Department, and we believe that it was John Ashcroft with other high-level officials, had the bright idea to say, well, let's use the material witness statute for a completely different purpose and in a completely illegal purpose. Let's go after individuals who happen to be Muslim and Arab men after 9/11 and say, we have suspicions about these people, but we do not have evidence to satisfy the normal probable cause standard, which is what it takes to arrest an individual in this country. And that is a bedrock principle of our country, that you need probable cause to arrest someone. Mere suspicion is not enough. What the government did is say, look, we have suspicions about these people. We're going to arrest them as material witnesses and say that they're a flight risk and they have testimony that's needed. And not only that, but they did it in secret. The door rooms were closed. The lawyers and the individuals were gagged. And so none of this came out right away. But it turns out dozens and dozens of Arab and Muslim men had been arrested as mere witnesses, held for months and months under the harshest conditions, far more fitting for a terrorism suspect than a witness.
When you say mere witnesses, you don't really mean they were mere witnesses, do you?
No, that's a good point. I should have said supposed witnesses or ostensibly witnesses, because they're arrested under the material witness statute and labeled by the government witnesses. We do not believe that most of them had material information. But even if they had material information, the critical point was that they have to be unwilling to provide that information. You don't simply go and arrest a witness. You give them a subpoena and they come. So take our guy then, Mr. Al-Kid. He had cooperated repeatedly with the FBI. He had been willing to testify. The government never said they may need him as a witness. They never told him, alert us if you're going to travel. They never told him anything. He had repeatedly cooperated.
He's an interesting guy. Let's take a step back and tell us a little bit about him. Who is he?
Yeah. He was born in Kansas, raised for some of his time in Los Angeles and most of the time at Seattle. He's an African-American man born in the United States. His parents are very accomplished. His father is actually a supervisor at the Chino Correctional Institute in California, and I think everyone knows it's a very sort of big prison in California. His mother has done work for IBM for the last 30 years. He was a football player. He ultimately went to the University of Idaho on a football scholarship and was a star football player there. After college, which was well before 9/11, I think right during college, but well before 9/11, toward the end of his college, he converted to Islam and then started working for charitable organizations. And everything was fine. Then 9/11 came about, and all of a sudden, everyone was being investigated, as you all know, and including in Idaho, which is a very small community, and they started going after all of the charities in Ida. Well, they also went after the charity that he happened to work for. So he was constantly being surveilled. He was under suspicion. We have all those records from the FBI that he was under surveillance.
Tell us a little bit about the kinds of surveillance.
From what we know, I'd like to say it's very glamorous, but it looked like the kind of records that we had where the cops were in the car eating donuts and the logs say Mr. Al-Kid went into the store, purchased some milk, came out, and they were repeatedly day after day of that nature, never saw any illegal activity. Ultimately, as far as we know, the surveillance was stopped, but I think they were constantly investigating him. And in fact, when they asked him to meet with them, supposedly about some other person's case, all of the questions were about his activities, trying to sort of build all the smoke into a fire. Ultimately, as you know, he was never charged with a crime, and in fact, he was never even called to testify. Supposedly, his testimony was needed for this other trial, the person who ran the charity, but he was never even called to testify. And interestingly, even that person was acquitted of all those charges.
But how long did he spend in prison?
He spent about 16 days in prison under the harshest possible conditions, shackled everywhere he went, strip searched, isolation, all of those types of things, as if he really were a very dangerous criminal. And then for 14 months, he was under very restrictive conditions, restricted travel to a few states, had to live with his in-laws in Nevada. And, you know, and many people say maybe that was the most draconian part of it, depending on who your in-laws are.
Lee, did he work for a Muslim charity?
Yes, he did.
Yeah, I think that would be significant. I think.
Yeah, no, I apologize if I left that out. It was a charity doing work like that. And, you know, he had done nothing wrong, but they were going after this charity, and he got caught up in it. And this is a classic case of they could never have charged him with a crime. They did not have probable cause to charge him with a crime. And, in fact, to this day, he's never been charged with a crime. Yet because at that time they had suspicions about so many people based on so little, they were able to take the material witness statute and convert it essentially into an arrest statute. And they arrested him based on the material witness statute, saying they went to the magistrate with an affidavit saying, we believe this man has material information and he won't voluntarily cooperate. And they said he was going to Saudi Arabia on a one-way first-class ticket. Well, it turns out that they later admitted, after he had spent the time in detention, that it was a round-trip coach ticket. They also admitted to, from the affidavit, did not tell the magistrate that he had repeatedly cooperated with the FBI, that he was a native-born U.S. citizen, and a variety of other facts that hopefully would have said to the magistrate, wait, maybe he has material information, maybe the government will ultimately want to call him to testify, but there's certainly no reason to be arresting him and certainly no reason to be holding him as if he was a terrorism suspect. None of the cooperation got mentioned in the affidavit. None of that stuff, the fact that he had U.S. citizen-born kids, the fact that he had a U.S. citizen-born wife, none of it got mentioned in the affidavit of the magistrate. It just made it seem like he was someone who was fleeing, who the FBI had no prior connection to.
And they didn't mention that he wasn't going to Saudi Arabia to disappear into the ether. He was going for a scholarship, study abroad.
Exactly. And not only that, but because the affidavit said Mr. Al-Kid has a one-way first-class ticket, and they actually put the price in, costing $5,000. Well, what they did is conjured up the whole MO of all of the hijackers, mm-hmm. who all had first-class one-ways.
So from 15 out of the 19 hijackers were
right.
Saudi Arabian.
Absolutely.
And that's complete
fabrication. And so what that looked like to the magistrate is they never even said he was a U.S. citizen. So what it looked like is this is a Saudi person who's fleeing, who has a lot of money.
What we're talking about with Legal Earned, who's the ACLU, won this extraordinary case regarding material witness warrants. What we're talking about is this misuse of material witness warrants post 9/11 to really round up and put in prison scores, if not more, Muslim men primarily.
Right. And one thing I want to emphasize, and I know you all know this, but you know, this case is going to stand as a test case, but one of the unfortunate things is that more people who are subjected to this material witness policy are not going to be able to sue for damages like Mr. Al-Kid has sued for, because what happened was, as I mentioned, everything was done in secret. By the time people started to learn about this, the people had been let out of detention, but sometimes after months and months and months. By the time we learned about them, not only had they been let out of detention, so we couldn't sue to get them out of detention, but the statute of limitations had already run because it had been 2 or 3 years before we uncovered the identities. So they're now barred from suing. I mean, they can, you know, hopefully look on this as something good for them, but obviously it's not the same as them being an actual plaintiff and obtaining money. And that's our goal, is not only to try and put an end to this practice and hold that it's unconstitutional so it never happens again, but to try and get some vindication from Mr. Al-Kid.
Now, this is a damage case, and you're suing Ashcroft. Are there other defendants as well as Ashcroft?
Yes. We are suing the Attorney General in his personal capacity and hope to get damages. We've also sued the two FBI agents who submitted the affidavit, which had all of those falsehoods and omissions. We've also sued them for damages. We've sued the United States as an entity under the Federal Tort Claims Act for money. And what we've also done is sued the three wardens who held Mr. Al-Kid in various places in the country for money. We've settled all three of those for monetary relief, a significant amount, against the federal government. And one thing that it's gone unnoticed is in one of those suits against the Oklahoma warden, a federal judge who was appointed by Ronald Reagan issued a stinging opinion saying a material witness cannot be strip searched without particularized evidence.
That's fabulous.
So that is a great thing, because one of the things that's happened is that people have focused on the arrest, and obviously that's the principal aspect of this case, but the conditions under which people have held. Because one thing we've always said is even if you had a right to arrest a material witness, you certainly can't hold them in conditions as if they are a criminal suspect. They need to be treated as if they're a witness. And so those are sort of two independent – I mean, they're related, but they're two independent parts, and we're very happy that we've settled against the three wardens.
Please tell us a little bit about the conditions or the circumstances of Mr. Al-Kid's arrest and some details about what happened to him subsequently in custody.
Sure. Well, he is at the airport, and he is ready to go to Saudi Arabia on sort of the biggest adventure of his life. The FBI come up to him, do not really explain what's going on, handcuff him. He asked that he not be let out of the airport in front of everyone in handcuffs because after 9/11, it's obviously going to look like he did something really wrong. They refuse. They parade him out. They bring him to a detention center in Virginia. He is made. He's first for the first 3 days put in a tiny little cell.
They take him from Oklahoma to Virginia.
He was arrested at Dulles Airport in Virginia first, and his second, which I'll get to, his second stop was Oklahoma, and then his third stop was finally out to Idaho. They bring him to a detention center in Virginia, and they put him in a small jail with a criminal. He's sleeping on the floor in a tiny little cell, clogged toilet, no change of clothes for 3 days.
What did they tell him?
They told him very little other than we may need you. You now may be needed as a material witness. And he repeatedly said, but I had cooperated. Why am I being arrested? Then they bring him to a hearing before a federal judge. They don't give him an attorney. And the federal judge said, he asks, very articulate for a layperson, especially given the trauma he's going through, and he asks the judge, why am I here? And the judge says, well, I don't know that much about it, but there's been a material witness warrant issued for in Idaho. And he says, but I've cooperated. I just want to get out of here. Why do I need to be arrested? The judge then informs him that you can only have an attorney if you want to go forward with the hearing, but the judge advised him to go back to Idaho because that's where they would know more about the situation. He then very carefully said, well, will that be quick? Because I certainly don't want to spend time in detention. The judge said there's no reason it shouldn't be quick and turned to the United States attorney and said, will it be quick? The United States attorney assured that it will be as quick as possible. He then says, okay, but still doesn't have an attorney. An attorney would have obviously, as you all know, said to the U.S. attorney and the judge, we'll do this if there's a stipulation that he's brought back, not in these conditions, and brought back within 24 hours. There certainly was no reason they couldn't have just put him on a plane right away. He goes back to the detention center, and he spends another 6 days there, moved to administrative segregation, shackled everywhere, strip searched, put with the most dangerous criminals in the system. 6 days later, they say they're moving him to Idaho, but first they're going to bring him to a transfer center in Oklahoma. They put him on a Conair plane, shackled, waist, hands, legs, with the most dangerous criminals. He goes to Oklahoma. He's separated out, made to sit naked in front of all the other detainees and the prison guards, spends 24 hours there, again, strip searched twice in 17 hours, put in isolated confinement. Finally, they put him back on the Conair plane the next morning and bring him to Idaho, where he's again subjected to these types of conditions. Ultimately, after 15 days, they go before the judge in Idaho, and he's released. The government admits that the plane ticket was they found out now that it was a round-trip ticket and a number of other things. He agrees to release under all of these conditions, but they're still constantly interrogating him. Ultimately, he does 14 months of these restrictive conditions. His marriage falls apart. He can't get employment. He's just emotionally a wreck.
What are the restrictive conditions?
He was limited to travel in a few states. He had to constantly check in with a probation officer. He had to live with his in-laws. You know, needless to say, his in-laws are looking at him like he is a terrorism suspect. And, you know, and one thing I didn't mention is that it's not as if all this is happening in secret. He was a football star in Idaho, so it splashed all over the papers out west. But even the Washington Post, which they must have got from the government, ran a huge article after his arrest with a picture of him. Buried somewhere in the article is that he's a material witness. Obviously, anybody reading that quickly is going to think the government's caught another terrorism suspect. And not only that, but the director of the FBI now and then, Director Mueller, went before Congress a few days after his arrest to report to Congress on the recent successes of the government in the terrorism fight. The first person Director Mueller mentioned was Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, that they had caught Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, and they were very pleased with that. The second person they mentioned was the arrest of Abdul Al-Kid, our client.
It's horrifying.
Never mentioning that he was a material witness. They then mentioned four other people, all of whom had actually been charged with terrorism. They repeated that testimony again before the Senate a few days later, never once mentioning that he was only a witness. All of that was splashed all over the country.
And for the rest of his life, anybody who Googles his name, an employer, a potential date, a friend, will come up with this guy as a terrorism suspect.
You sued Ashcroft and others in their personal capacity. Does that mean that if you prevail against them, that they have to pay this money out of their own personal funds?
Yeah, I mean, that's a good question, and Michael can jump in when he wants. You know, generally speaking, they will not. They'll have insurance for that, so they will not.
Insurance?
I am not an expert on exactly how it works, but generally speaking, the government will pay it. And so what?
So we pay it.
Right, that's one way to look at it. And, you know, so in many ways, it's a legal fiction to think that they're going to be burdened by the judgment, you know, and maybe they should be burdened, but I think there's policy reasons why it's worked out like this. From Mr. Al-Kid's standpoint, he would like to have a ruling that says Mr. Ashcroft did this, and he would like to have some vindication and some money, and I think he's less concerned of whether it comes out of Mr. Ashcroft's pocket, but you're absolutely right to point that out. Yeah.
You get a personal judgment against a former federal official for violating the law is very rare in these kind of high-level cases.
It would have
cases.
Been even more delicious to make Ashcroft
right.
pay for it.
No,
the reason is that after Ashcroft left his job as attorney general, he got a job doing PR work,
right.
and he was bragging publicly about how much money he was making and how much he enjoyed it.
I mean, now he has a lobby firm, and he's at a lobby firm and a law firm.
Right, absolutely.
Right?
And there are significant oddities about all this. I mean, the other thing is that the Justice Department is defending him. And so I think that's an interesting aspect to the case, what will happen now. Because up till now, the Justice Department has been defending him. I assume the Justice Department will continue defending him, but it's his choice whether he wants to get private lawyers. One thing I think that you all have put your finger on is the fact that a high-level official is being held personally. I mean, that is very rare for the Attorney General of the United States to be held personally liable. And I think the Justice Department is probably going to view it as them having an institutional interest in getting rid of this ruling, unrelated to what they think about Mr. Ashcroft, his actions, and even unrelated to national security and 9/11. Because the ruling goes beyond even that and says that the Attorney General cannot have absolute immunity for these types of issues. And that's going to be a big thing for the Justice Department to consider when they decide how to proceed. I mean, it's a very complicated area of the law, but if I could sort of simplify it to the best I can, there are official capacity suits and personal capacity suits, but the personal capacity suit, I think, is somewhat of a misnomer in this sense. If the Attorney General of the United States were driving down the street and had a car accident, unrelated to his duties as the Attorney General, he could be sued like anybody else in a sort of basic tort action or something like that, or was having a dispute with his neighbor about the fields in his backyard or something along those lines. What we're talking about here is the Attorney General taking actions as the Attorney General, adopting this nationwide policy for the Justice Department. And then once he's doing those types of actions, you can have two types of suits. You can have an official action against him, which simply means that the government has to change their policies. But if you want to get money from the Attorney General, then you would call it a personal action. So in a sense, it's a sort of hybrid. It's him taking public actions on behalf of the United States for the Justice Department in our name, but we call it a personal capacity suit because what we're asking for are damages, that he's so crossed the line and the law was so clearly established and he acted so unreasonably that we think our client is entitled not just to a change in policy, but to actual damages from the Attorney General.
And Ashcroft was claiming that because his position as Attorney General was prosecutorial, he had absolute immunity.
Absolutely.
Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, and that's a very big issue. I mean, there is a lot of case law that we had to overcome about absolute immunity, saying that prosecutors generally shouldn't be sued when they're taking prosecutorial actions. And I think it developed because the courts were worried that defendants would constantly sue the prosecutor, saying you were acting out of politics or racism. So generally speaking, no matter how egregious the facts are, you cannot sue a prosecutor. Well, what we alleged here was that the Attorney General wears two hats. Yes, the Attorney General does prosecute and has prosecutorial functions, but he also has investigative functions as the head of the FBI. And what we claimed was that all of these people, including our client, were being arrested so the government could investigate them, that the government it wasn't at the stage of prosecuting anybody. And that's a line the Supreme Court has drawn, but there's very little case law. And we had only found one other time when the Attorney General of the United States had ever pierced the absolute immunity, and that was during the wiretapping with Attorney General Mitchell, and that's a long time ago. So there was a lot of case law to overcome. We were very pleased with the opinion that really wrestled with that case law and drew what we think was the right distinction.
Now that makes this even more extraordinary.
Does it matter that at that time the government was generally going after Muslim charities? Is this case in the context of that assault on Muslim charities?
Well, I think you definitely cannot separate all of that. But what the government argued on their absolute immunity point was, yes, national security was an additional reason why you wouldn't allow the immunity to pierce. But what they essentially argued was the attorney general has to have absolute immunity. And even if this case did not involve discrimination in post 9/11, there should be absolute immunity for the attorney general. And that's one reason that I mentioned earlier why I think the Justice Department is going to institutionally view this as a major decision unrelated to what the current administration may now, you know, see as wrongs committed by Attorney General Ashcroft, if in fact they do actually see those as wrongs. And, you know, and we obviously have a mixed record so far.
What was extraordinary, I think, was that language that said what the United States Constitution, really the Fourth Amendment, requires. What is that language that the court, what did it say?
Absolutely, because what we have always said in our country, and it has been a bedrock principle that now is under fire after 9/11, is there's no such thing as suspicion that someone committed a crime, and we're going to lock you up and try and investigate it then. There's only two ways to go. You're innocent unless the government has probable cause to believe you've committed a crime.
And what does probable cause mean?
Probable cause is a lower standard than conviction, but it means that there's reasonable belief, objective reasonable belief, that you've committed a crime. So it cannot just be law enforcement acting under suspicion. And that has always been an enormous part of the United States. In other countries, people are arrested on suspicion. Here, no one can be arrested on suspicion. And that was viewed as a solid principle for 200 years prior to 9/11. And I think that's what the government is doing an end run around. And that's what I think the court was so disturbed by, is that they're violating something so basic to our Constitution that mere suspicion cannot land you in jail. And, you know, even if there was some basis, if it doesn't rise to the level of probable cause, it can't be. In our case, it was certainly unfounded suspicion. And I think that really shows the danger of what's happened post 9/11, is suspicion is really meaningless until you can actually put some hard facts to it. And too many Muslim and Arab men have ended up in detention based on mere and unfounded suspicion.
What's the current situation of the use of material witness warrant? Did it start tailing off at the end of the Bush administration? Has it tailed off? What's the position of the current administration on that?
Right. The short answer is we were not positive what was happening at the end of the Bush administration, and are not positive what's happening on the ground now with the Obama administration, or even what the Obama administration's policy will ultimately be. And the reason is because so much happened in secret with the material witness statute, we have never been sure we understood the full contours of it. We have asked repeatedly and been denied information about the material witness statute in the aggregate. We're not able to get it in any case. We believe it tailed off toward the end, but we're certainly not sure. But I think what's critically important is the government has never denounced this policy. So if we were ever to be in a situation where the government felt they needed to use it again, without a court ruling, they would be free to do it. There have been some policies post 9/11 that even the Bush administration ultimately said we're going to change. This government has never said it. And the only thing I would add about the Obama administration is that the administration's changed over while this case was pending. The court asked for supplemental briefing on recent Supreme Court decisions, one of which is the Iqbal decision, which also involved Attorney General Ashcroft and 9/11. The Obama administration submitted that brief and a very, very forceful brief saying the lawsuit had to be thrown out. So right now we've seen nothing about the Obama administration on this. We don't know what their position ultimately will be. We hope that it'll change their position. But, of course, the attorney general can then get private lawyers and continue with the lawsuit. And I suspect he will, the former attorney general.
What separates this case from the Brandon Mayfield case, another case of a material witness where he got an apology?
I'm not sure there's a lot that separates it. I think conceptually they're the same. You know, ultimately we may get an apology. I don't know. I think the government's mistake in that case was so much more public, and you had another government saying there was a mistake. Maybe the government settled that case quicker, I think. You know, but I don't know that they were trying to systematically get at the nationwide policy in the same way that we are. And I think Mr. Al-Kid feels very strongly that he not only wants vindication for himself, but he sort of has a larger social justice position that what happened to him and other people is wrong. And I think he would like to – I think he was very pleased with this decision that the Federal Court of Appeals finally recognized the wrong that was committed here.
And three Republican appointees, although one dissented, were on the Ninth Circuit panel. What happens next? I mean, you've won a case in the Ninth Circuit. The next appeal would be presumably to the Supreme Court if the government wants to take it up. If not, it goes back for a trial of some sort against Ashcroft, I guess.
Right. The government has a few choices, and Mr. Ashcroft has a few choices. They can go back to the district court and let us do discovery, which in a sense means find out what the actual facts are. He also can appeal, and he can ask the full Court of Appeals to hear it, or he can go directly to the Supreme Court. I think everyone's guess is that he will appeal rather than going back directly to the district court, but I think we're, you know, only time will tell. He has 45 days from the original decision to ask the full Court of Appeals or 90 days to ask the Supreme Court. Most people assume that he will not sit with the decision and the Justice Department will not live with the decision and will want to appeal it.
Lee Glorant, Deputy Director of the ACLU's Immigration Rights Project. Congratulations on an amazing victory.
Thank you.
Good
thank
luck
you
to
having
you.
Me.
Yeah.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org.
Earlier this month, a Muslim civil rights group filed a lawsuit against the FBI's refusal to make public its surveillance guidelines of civic and religious organizations in connection with criminal investigations. The group Muslim Advocates, a national legal and educational organization, filed a Freedom of Information Act suit against the Department of Justice. The lawsuit is seeking the text of the Domestic Investigative Operational Guidelines. The, quote, DIOGS, which went into effect last December, is a practical manual interpreting revised surveillance guidelines. The interesting part of the story is that the civil rights group, including Muslim Advocates, were shown drafts of the FBI surveillance guidelines under the Bush administration, but haven't yet been given a copy under the Obama administration. We're joined now by Muslim Advocates Executive Director Farhana Kara to discuss the lawsuit and concerns over federal agents infiltrating mosques and so-called mapping of communities where American Muslims reside.
Farhana Kara, Executive Director of Muslim Advocates, thanks for joining us on Law and Disorder.
Thanks for having me.
Farhana, tell us, what is it that Muslim Advocates wants to find out from the FBI and why?
Sure. So the American Muslim community, Dahlia, has been very concerned about the continuing expansion of powers given to the FBI. Just this year, in the last several months, there have been a number of incidents where, for example, there have been what are called agent provocateurs that have been sent into mosques. Agent provocateurs are basically informants who are sent into mosques, and they make provocative statements about violence in an attempt to recruit individuals to a purported terror plot. And as you can imagine, this has created quite a bit of fear in the community. You know, an American Muslim shouldn't have to look over their shoulders while they pray, fearing that an FBI agent or informant is watching them. That's just one example of the level of concerns. We've also received reports from people in the community who've gotten knocks on the door from the FBI wanting to talk to them and ask them questions without any suspicion of criminal wrongdoing, but based on political views that they've put out in public forums.
For years, the FBI was doing this openly.
Correct.
And not at all hiding the fact that they were just targeting Muslims for investigation and questioning, not based on criminality or suspicion of wrongdoing, but based on religion.
Mm-hmm. So these are a number of concerns, and obviously after September 11th, there was greater efforts by the FBI to go out into the community and be knocking on people's doors. But what's particularly concerned us at Muslim Advocates is in the waning days of the Bush administration, there were a set of revised guidelines that were issued by the Attorney General and then a set of guidelines issued by the FBI implementing those guidelines issued by the Attorney General that further potentially expand the FBI's powers. Muslim Advocates and a group of other privacy and civil liberties groups were allowed to see a draft version of those FBI guidelines almost a year ago, last November. But during that meeting, we were not allowed to keep a copy of those draft guidelines. And then 1 to 2 weeks after that meeting, those guidelines were finalized and went into effect. So since that time, we've been seeking the final copy of the guidelines, an unredacted copy of those guidelines. We've sought those through formal channels and then filed a Freedom of Information Act request. You know, it's been almost a year later, and we still have not gotten a copy of the guidelines. And that's why we went forward last week and filed suit then.
That's a little curious, Farhana. They showed you, the FBI showed you a draft of their near finalized guidelines. So
yes.
you had a chance to read it?
Yes.
And
yes.
Now they've refused to show you the final copy that was finalized 1 week after that date.
Correct.
Why do you suppose that is?
It's hard to say, but I think what concerns us is, you know, certainly with President Obama's commitment after his inauguration to greater transparency and openness in government, that given this new tenor in Washington, we would certainly hope that the FBI would also be working consistent with the president's commitment to greater transparency and openness and actually produce the guidelines. I mean, one thing the FBI has said to us that does cause us some concern is that they've said that our request is under review and that they may be making redactions or blacking out sections of the guidelines, and that's why it's taking so long. That also causes us concern because the copy of the draft guidelines we saw were a clean, unredacted version. So again, we think the public has a right to know how the expansive powers given to the FBI and being wielded in our name are actually being used.
So, Farhana, let me see if I understand this. The Bush administration, in the waning days of their rule, mm-hmm. showed you an unredacted copy of the FBI guidelines, and now the Obama administration is withholding those same guidelines.
Yes, yes.
Now Dahlia, you said it pretty well, I guess, and you got an affirmative from Farhana. I guess I don't want to interrupt this line of questioning, but what did the guidelines say that you saw?
Yeah, just to give you some level of concern, and I must say it was a short period of time in which we were allowed to see the draft version, and again, it was like a 100-plus page document. But there were some troubling things that we did see in there. For example, there was a reference to gathering data about racial and ethnic communities, basically kind of smacking of what's been called mapping or geo-mapping of communities. And you might recall that there was an effort by the Los Angeles Police Department a couple of years ago to engage in a mapping project and map the Muslim American community in the Los Angeles area. And that was met with quite a quick public rebuke, and then it forced the LAPD to actually scrap those plans. So
how widespread was the racial and ethnic targeting? What did they mention, specific ethnicities and religions?
It was described as racial and ethnic mapping in the guidelines themselves. That's what we know at this time, and that's why we're interested in knowing what the actual final guidelines say and what they were, how they've actually been finalized, and you know, for us to have a better understanding of what the implementation might be. Obviously, as you can see, that it causes a lot of concern in the community about how these powers are being used and whether a particular community is being targeted because of religion and the impact that has, particularly when it comes to issues like freedom of religion and free expression.
Did you see anything about targeted questionings or visiting and surveilling houses of worship?
The way that it's framed, it tends to be framed in terms of public forums and public places. So again, this is one of those areas where we want to be able to have a chance to fully review the guidelines to be able to see what it means in terms of places like houses of worship, other public meetings and gatherings, and even things like public online forums, popular social networking forums. We want to be able to actually be able to closely review the document. And I would just emphasize that we were given a limited time to actually review the draft document, so we were not able to actually closely, thoroughly go through the entire section. And I think that's true of not only us, but the other civil liberties groups that were in those meetings.
How long did you have to look at the 100 pages?
The meeting lasted probably no more than an hour, and during that time there was obviously other discussions and things like that as well. So
this really was you just being able to skim it and look at headlines.
Correct. Correct.
What else did you see that concerned you?
Those are the key things. I would say the other kind of key issue, but some of this also relates to the Attorney General's guidelines that were issued, deals with lowering the factual threshold that allows the FBI to actually initiate what they call threat assessments. And it's basically lowering those standards so that it used to be at one time that you actually, an FBI agent actually needed, had to have some factual basis for believing that someone was engaged in criminal activity and even needed supervisory approval before actually initiating investigations. And what we've seen since 9/11 is that there's been the revised guidelines last year, but even beginning with the then Attorney General Ashcroft, there's been a couple of these revisions to the surveillance guidelines that have been lowering the threshold to initiate investigations that are basically also moving it down to the discretion of a line agent without supervisory controls and without there being kind of a factual basis to believe there's criminal activity taking place and that kind of thing. So we know that that has also occurred.
Farhana, that's a really good point that you bring up. Can you give us an example of how that would work on the street? What that would look like in real terms for a person, an FBI agent?
What that could mean, for example, just to give you an example of a particular individual who contacted us, this was somebody who is a prominent prominent physician of Pakistani descent. He was contacted by the FBI after he had made some statements in a local newspaper in which he was being interviewed about the political situation in Pakistan. And he had made some statements that were actually pro-democracy in nature. He was expressing his support for democracy to actually take hold in Pakistan. And a couple of days later, after he made that statement, he got a knock on the door from the FBI wanting to ask him some questions about, probe him further about his views of American foreign policy towards Pakistan, his views of the leaders of Pakistan, and just kind of generally asking and probing him. And fortunately, he reached out to us and was interested in seeking the advice of a lawyer before he actually agreed to speak to them. And we certainly do encourage people who are contacted by the FBI to seek counsel. But that's just one example. There was, in this gentleman's statement, there was no reason to believe that this gentleman is engaged in any kind of criminal activity. But it's kind of this, almost this fishing expedition. Well, let's talk. Let's kind of poke around, see what we might be able to uncover and things.
Farhana, Michael Smith here. I think that's precisely what it is: fishing expedition. You know, we've now gone past the 8-year anniversary of 9/11. 15 Saudi Arabians, out of sheer luck and bureaucratic blunderness on the part of America, managed to crash these planes into a building. Now what we have 8 years later, I think because of this tremendous inertia, the machine is just all wound up and it's chewing up people. I think racism plays a big factor in it. If you step back and see it, it's like ridiculous. What are they doing looking into mosques in New Jersey? They should have been looking somewhere else 8 years ago. And now we're paying the price for their failures 8 years ago.
Yeah. So I think this is part of the concern is that at some level, you know, law enforcement, FBI agents are going to use the power that's given to them. And I think a lot of what we've heard just as beginning with the Bush administration is this attitude of don't worry, trust us. And I think what's important and kind of the lessons learned is that there's limited resources eventually, whether it's in terms of, you know, actual time of law enforcement agents or the kinds of resources that they have. And it's really incumbent on us, the American people, American taxpayers, to ensure that law enforcement is actually using the resources and the powers they've been given in a way that's actually focused on those bad actors and people actually engaged in wrongdoing.
When you talked earlier about ethnic and racial mapping, and, you know, I'd be interested in what that is. I mean, I understand it's not sitting in your office and just taking a census and saying X number of Muslims live in this area, X number of Pakistanis. It's more overt than that. What is racial and ethnic mapping?
Yeah, it's something that we're also still trying to get a hold of and get a better understanding of. And it might be in part, we know at one point there was an effort by law enforcement to actually get access to some of the Bureau of Census data that deals with racial and ethnic data around the country. But for example, just to give you an example, what was being proposed in Los Angeles, as I understand it, is that there would be an effort by where basically police officers would be encouraged to go out into the community to be collecting information, so it would go beyond even just kind of here, you know, what's the race and ethnic makeup of this particular household, but they would ask questions and try to collect data about the education background of the people in the household, the ages, demographic data about these particular communities. But again, it was focused on people who were Muslim in that particular area. And again, from what we've seen, you know, I think we have a lot of questions about what does that mean in the federal law enforcement context, and what exactly is the FBI contemplating in that regard? I think it's a big mystery.
Farhana Kara of Muslim Advocates, how can our listeners get in touch with your organization?
Yeah, sure. Well, Well, we encourage listeners to visit our website at www.muslimadvocates.org. And I would particularly encourage your listeners, if anyone needs, has been, you know, contacted by the FBI, has gotten that knock on the door, to also view our Know Your Rights video that we have on our website as well. And it's available in 5 languages to assist people who have gotten knocks on the door. www.muslimadvocates.org.
Farhana, Kara, thank you very much for being on Law and Disorder.
Great. Thanks for having me.
And thank you for filing that lawsuit. I'm be very interested in seeing the guidelines when you get them, although it sounds like they're going to be blacked out a bit.
Great. Yeah.
Bye-bye.
Yeah.
Take it
bye-bye.
Easy.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org.